Wednesday, March 3rd, 2410. Nekomikoka Tomodachi. Unlike Uchna, who had fled clear to New Avalon to escape the madness of the wedding plans, Corwin Ravenhair had taken a simpler evasive route. He had sought refuge from the storm not outside the solar system, but within a shell of practical considerations. Let his mother and aunts and Anthe fret over the details of the wedding if they liked. He was more concerned with what happened afterward. Well, not immediately afterward. He had a pretty good idea what that was going to entail. But once the celebrations and whatnot were over, there were going to be things to do. Between the troubles in Asgard that began the previous summer, the sudden and unexpected realignment that followed his return to Midgard, and the, ye gods, impending birth of his child, Corwin's life had been uncomfortably in flux for the better part of a year, and he wasn't alone. The Tenjos and Caitlin had had no better a time of it, riding out the rest of the much-battered summer tour, and then finding that life was reluctant to slip back into its accustomed patterns afterward. He was up a tree, of all places, doodling geometric patterns on a sketch pad and considering all this, when he heard a rustling from below. Ah, hell, who wants what now? He thought. But a moment later, someone he wasn't expecting clambered up from below. Ugh, said Hiroshi Morisato as he heaved himself up onto a stout branch not far from Corwin's perch. I thought I might find you up here. Phew, he added, wiping sweat from his forehead with one arm. Did you have to climb this far up? It's not like most of the people who'd be looking for you can't fly anyway. Corwin had to admit his cousin had a point. Did Aunt Belle send you looking for me? Whatever it is, I'm not getting in the middle of it. I already told Erd. One more hassle out of either one of them, and I swear we'll elope. Hiroshi chuckled. No, I think they actually took you seriously. I just figured you might want some company that isn't obsessed with your impending nuptials. When you left the temple, you had that preoccupied look. What's on your mind? Corwin gave Hiroshi a thoughtful look for a second, then sighed. I'm not sure. I feel strange. He blew out a breath. Something's going to happen, I think, but I don't know what. Hiroshi looked interested. You had a vision? He asked, but Corwin shook his head. No, Corwin said, not as such. I don't have Mom's direct connection to the future. When I touch what might be, it's always involuntary. Usually in a dream, and so cryptic that I can hardly ever make any use of it. This is different. I'm not really sure how I can describe it. I'm one of the Aesir. I can't see the future, but I can feel the heft and swing and momentum of the universe. Hiroshi nodded. I think I know what you mean. I never wanted to be a god like you, so I let that part of me lie, but it's still in my blood. And sometimes it's like I catch a glimpse of the, I don't know how to say it, the circuitry. Corwin's eyebrows went up. He'd known Hiroshi all his life, but he'd never known that. Hiroshi caught his look of surprise and grinned slightly. Might just be my imagination, he said, playing it off. But I think I can imagine more or less what you're getting at. You feel like something's in motion that wasn't before. Corwin nodded, encouraged. Exactly. I think some fundamental shift in the order of things is in progress, has been since just about last June. Everything I've seen and experienced and discovered since then feels like part of a pattern. My instincts tell me it's all important, all connected, but not why or how. He sighed again. That might just be my imagination, but he looked Hiroshi in the eye. I feel like everything's about to change, and it makes me uneasy. Well, Hiroshi said, things are about to change. You're getting married. You'll be a father soon. He shook his head with a smile. You waited around until you graduated from high school and then just sort of put your head down and bull-rushed adulthood. It was a very you thing to do. Corwin laughed. It wasn't entirely my idea, he said. No, I suppose not, Hiroshi conceded. Then, more seriously, he said, you guys are leaving Tomodachi, aren't you? I'm not sure, Corwin replied. I've been thinking about it, but I haven't mentioned it to anyone. Nobody to mention it to right at the moment, he added with a rueful chuckle. But with Kate back in New Avalon, and Juri and Miki, and Wakaba talking about following them and the child coming so soon, the Psi-Corps still skulking around, that mess with the Klingons, Utena getting involved with the Jedi, the Sith, whatever the hell Akio is up to. He glanced up at the sky. I feel kind of exposed here. He gave Hiroshi a slightly helpless look. Hell, I thought about trying to get them to move back to Sephiro, at least until some of this shit settles, but that's a bit extreme. Even if I really wanted to go that far, I'd never get Utena to go along with it. Might not be a bad idea at that. I mean, you're not going to see many Sith lords in Sephiro, Hiroshi said. But you're probably right, she wouldn't go for it. It'd be too much like running for a bolt hole. Then he cracked a small grin. Well, if it makes you feel any better about New Avalon, I'm bound there myself in a few months. Corwin blinked. You are? Yep. End of this school year, I'm transferring to NAIS. Professor Voroshilova thinks I should pursue a pure science foundation, at least at the undergraduate level, rather than engineering. You wouldn't have persuaded her of that just to get away from Mirai, would you? Corwin asked. Hiroshi looked faintly irked. I love my sister, he said piously. Even if she is a fashion-obsessed airhead without even vestigial critical faculties. She'll surprise you one day, Corwin said. Maybe, said Hiroshi, unconvinced. Anyway, I'll be around. Living on campus, at least the first year. Mom thinks if I get my own place, I'll just be partying all the time. Corwin snorted. That's what I said, Hiroshi agreed. But what can you do? True that, Corwin said. Well, I'll keep that in mind anyway, he went on. I don't know quite what I'm going to do yet. We have to get this damn wedding behind us before I'll even have time to bring it up. He smiled. But if we do move, it'll be nice to know you're nearby. Yeah, Hiroshi said. Like old times. He looked down, sighed, and then started working his way off his perch. I better get back. Before they come looking for me and find you. Take it easy, Corwin. You too, Hiroshi. Corwin reached out a fist. Hiroshi touched it with his own. And thanks. Hey, what are fellow mad scientists for? Hiroshi asked rhetorically, and then he was gone. Corwin listened to the branches rustle as his cousin made his way down. Then there was a crack, a curse, a heavy thud, and a faint, okay, from far below. Corwin smiled for a moment. Then his expression went far away again, and his marker resumed tracing the intricate pattern he had begun almost an hour before. Below, Hiroshi dusted himself off and started walking back toward the temple, hands in his pockets. In the right one, he felt the cool surface of a metal rectangle against his fingertips. Maybe I should have shown it to him, he thought. But then, no, he's got enough on his mind right now. Besides, it's not perfected yet. He'll think I'm trying to get him to help me with it. And that's not the point at all. I want to be able to help him with it, not the other way around. Orifos. Anakin Skywalker was getting a bit fed up. Being a young man naturally inclined toward action, Anakin had little patience for or understanding of political maneuvering. Oh, he knew it when he saw it. He wasn't hopelessly naive. But he preferred to leave it to others, preferably others he didn't have to deal with himself. Unfortunately, that wasn't entirely an option at the Otori Institute. As he stalked the corridors of the training hall looking for his master, Anakin reflected with no small inner annoyance at the situation in which he found himself. It seemed like everyone of any prominence within the Order of the Black Rose had his own agenda, and all the different factions eyed each other with mutual suspicion, not to say loathing. The smooth-talking, conniving Sith Lord, Darth Venger, had a number of acolytes among the Institute's younger students, and they held themselves aloof from those who studied under Mikage. The Kiryus, though they answered directly to Akio, were locked in a constant antagonism of their own, bizarrely united by their hatred of each other. And in their way they echoed the division of the Order itself, for Toga was a student of Venger's, while Nanami followed Mikage's path. Only the armored warlords from Kaneko, mercenaries who seemed to have joined Akio's cause mainly out of boredom with the mortal world, had any real solidarity among themselves, and even there the fault lines were evident. And standing off to one side, as uninterested in Venger's dark whisperings as he was in Mikage's arcane parables, was Kyuichi Sionji, Anakin's master. Sionji maintained his place in the Order without seeking the support of either Dark Master through sheer force of will, and by being so fearsome that none of the others dared to challenge him. Anakin felt a certain pride at that, the idea that even men like Lord Venger and Toga Kiryu feared his master. Not everyone did, though. The warlords, for instance. They cared little for the internal politics of the Order, in part because their group obviously had a pecking order of its own, and Anakin had the distinct impression that at least one of them, that one-eyed freak Rajara, knew, or at least suspected, that Sionji's commitment to the Black Rose was not, shall we say, complete. And then, of course, there was Onubishu. Anakin suspected him of being the most powerful single member of the Order at the moment, and though he feared no man, he was realist enough to rate his chances of survival pretty low if Onubishu should ever seriously decide to take him out. Not that he considered that very likely. The Masho leader obviously had bigger fish to fry. Anakin wasn't sure Onubishu would even consider it worth his time to try and eliminate Sionji, let alone his student. Under the circumstances, the thought was not particularly comforting. He looked into the next of the training rooms and saw not Sionji, but one of the younger students, apparently putting in some additional training time during what should have been a rare free hour. She was slim and olive-skinned, with her black hair cut short and swept away from her face. She had one of the standard dueling sabers, and Anakin could tell from the training exercise she was doing that she was one of Mikage's students. Anakin stood in the door for a few moments, watching her work. She was quite young, ninth form at most, probably younger, but her intensity was remarkable. Though her technique wasn't perfect, it was better than most of her peers, and she burned in the force with a clean black flame, the searing intensity of a soul fully focused on some dark purpose. Anakin wondered how someone so young could possibly hate so much. Even he hadn't been so full of fury at her age. After a few moments, she felt his eyes on her and stopped what she was doing. For a moment, she merely regarded him in turn. Now that she'd stopped moving and faced him fully, Anakin could see that her eyes were a brown so dark they looked black, and her face would have been pretty if it hadn't been so hard and cold. "You're Sionji's apprentice," she said at length. "Skywalker. Curious name, that. Could be Norse. Are you from Asgard?" Anakin shook his head. "Tatooine," he replied wryly. and you're one of the wizard's students, but I don't know your name. Lena, she told him. Lena Tarrant. She tilted her head as a thought came to her. You're a samurai, right? Well, I will be, Anakin allowed. Spar with me, Lena said. Demanded, really. Anakin arched an eyebrow. Why? He asked. Because I need to learn how to kill your kind. She replied flatly, a hard light glittering in her dark eyes. He looked nonplussed for a moment, then shrugged. Sure, why not? He said. Then, regarding her iron saber, he frowned, saying, It'll be a short fight if I use my lightsaber against that. He turned and regarded the rack of weapons on the back wall of the room. Most of the practice rooms in the training center had one, a display of sorts featuring weapons gathered from all over the 10 worlds by Lord Akio's recruiters at the same time they gathered the students. Anakin looked the rack over, searching for something suitably Japanese, but found nothing. This rack had a more Western theme. He scanned it a second time, considering his options. It wouldn't do to spar with an axe, he supposed. And that spiked metal ball suspended on a foot-long chain from a wooden handle looked like fun, but certainly wasn't suitable for a practice fight with a 9th-form student. The gladius was too short. He wouldn't have known where to begin with a halberd, and... ooh. Surmounting the display like a banner was the largest sword Anakin had ever seen, barring, perhaps, on Nobishu's Nodachi. It was straight, slightly tapered near the end, with a simple crossguard and round pommel, its long grip carved from some dark wood, its blade hidden within a matching scabbard trimmed in silver. Curious, Anakin took it down from its perch. It was slightly heavier than it looked, heavier than a steel sword of its size would have been. Sliding it from its scabbard, he saw that the blade was made of a slightly opalescent metal that gleamed under the practice room's lights a deep, near-black violet color. It was double-edged, with deep twin fullers, and like the scabbard, its last third had a gentle taper to a point. There was an inscription on it, etched between the fullers in silver, but he didn't recognize the letters or the language. Anakin regarded the sword for a few moments, hefting it in his metal hand. Despite its weight, it was beautifully balanced, inviting him to go ahead and swing it around a bit. This he did, slowly at first, then more quickly as he assured himself that his strength was equal to the challenge of managing the heavy blade. It felt unfamiliar, unlike any of the practice weapons he had handled with Sionji, entirely unlike the way a lightsaber felt in his hands. But also right in a way that he couldn't define. He finished his probing mini-kata and walked to the center of the room. Ready? He asked Lena. She flourished her saber and assumed an aggressive ready stance. Try to keep that big bastard under control, she said, and came at him. He blocked her easily, crossing his forearms and dipping his greatsword low into the side, his hands spread as wide as they could get on the long grip. Lena's saber rang against the lustrous metal with a low, clear sound, more like the sounding of a bell than the clash of two swords. Anakin took it easy, letting her come to him, defending against her attacks until he had a better idea of her strength and speed. She was stronger than she looked, her muscles lean but wiry, but he was, as he had expected, far stronger. Still, she was quick, and she was ferocious, and, as he'd figured when watching her exercise, the Force was with her. Anakin smiled. This might just be fun. He blocked her next attack, thrust her weapon aside, and whirled into a counterattack, turning completely around to get more power behind his blade. He wouldn't connect with her body, he'd made sure of that, but he wanted to see how smart she was. Smart enough. Lena didn't try to parry a blow delivered with all the might of a tall, broad-shouldered young man wielding a 6-foot greatsword. At best, that would have gotten her jarred badly out of position. At worst, the blow could have shattered her sword, her wrist, or both. Instead, she dropped to the floor, letting it pass over her, then rolled upright and sprang to the attack, looking to capitalize on the follow-through Anakin would be forced to make after such an extravagant blow. His experience told here, too. Rather than try to reverse his blade, Anakin rode the momentum through a further half-turn and brought the sword down across his body, catching her counterattack and turning it aside. Lena's teeth showed slightly, a hint of a smile stealing across her usual battle scowl as she conceded the engagement and backed off to regroup. Anakin didn't give her time to do that. He went on the offensive, switching his feet and trying for an overhand cut. Lena again avoided the blow rather than trying to turn it, thinking he might overbalance himself and hit the floor. And he nearly did, for he still wasn't entirely accustomed to the weight of this weapon. Only his uncommon strength prevented that from happening, and he was so occupied with the task that Lena had a clear shot at him from the left. She bore it in, intending to smack him on the forehead with the flat of her saber, since this was not a formal duel and he had no rose to take. He thrust out his left hand, palm open, and the force hit Lena like a heavy gust of wind, blunting her charge and sending her staggering. Her saber fell from her hand, clanging to the floor as she thrashed to keep her balance. This reversal had an entirely unexpected effect. Anakin figured she might be mad that he'd shown her up so thoroughly. Or, if she were game for more, that she'd retrieve her weapon and then they'd start again. Instead, she crumpled to her knees, face and hands, and began sobbing. Anakin blinked. Hesitantly, he went back to the wall and collected his new sword's scabbard. Distracted as he was by Lena's sudden disintegration, he didn't even think of putting the weapon back on the wall. Instead, he sheathed it and absently slung it across his back by the attached baldric. Then, hesitantly, he crossed to Lena and crouched in front of her. Are you okay? I didn't hurt you, did I? He asked. Lena continued to sob for a few moments, then seemed to regain some of her composure. She dashed the tears from her eyes with a sleeve, wiped her hands down her face, and sat pulling herself together for a moment. Anakin was surprised at the transformation in her face. This moment of vulnerability had wiped away the usual harshness of her expression, revealing it as a mask. The face beneath was, as he had suspected, quite striking.
No, she finally replied, still sniffling a little. I'm just so frustrated. How am I supposed to get my revenge when I can't even beat some punk apprentice?
Anakin looked faintly insulted, but his curiosity overrode any annoyance he might have felt.
Revenge? What revenge? He asked.
For a second, Lena looked like she might tell him. But then her face closed down, turning back to a hard, ruthless mask. Never mind, she said, rising to her feet. Clearly embarrassed by her outburst, she collected her saber, hung it up, said coldly, "Thanks for an interesting session," and left. Anakin stood looking after her for a few moments, wondering what had just happened. But before he could decide whether to go after her or resume his search for Sionji, someone else had entered the room.
"Ah, Anakin, just the person I'm looking for," said Mia Ausa. "Do you have a minute? I need to borrow you and your lightsaber."
Sure, why not?" he said after a moment's hesitation.
Sephiro. Suwabuki entered the student council's meeting room a few minutes late and found everyone he'd called on waiting for him. The five gathered before him were his closest friends in Sephiro, the other current members of the Order of the Rose's home chapter. Seeing them, knowing that he had been chosen to lead them, never failed to give his heart a little swell of pride, no matter what distractions weighed on his mind.
Members of the Order, who were also, by definition, members of the Tenjo Academy Student Council, were set apart from their fellows by the uniforms they wore, which were much more formal and ornate than those worn by rank-and-file students. Each member was permitted a few embellishments to his or her uniform as well, in order to display a tad of individualism, a reflection of the diversity that made up their common strength. Thus, Tsuwabuki himself wore black-trimmed gold, a color not seen on any other student at the academy, to honor the memory of a lost friend. Keiko Sonoda was the only counselor in some time to wear a skirt, longer and more heavily pleated than those worn by regular female students, with her gray jacket. She sat at the conference table, upright and expectant, legs crossed elegantly at the knee, with her brown hair drawn back and her dark eyes keeping her thoughts private. She had her katana lying on the table in front of her in its scabbard, out of the way, but ready to hand. Standing next to her seat, Carden Feltz sported white-edged black, his jacket subtly cut to evoke the livery of the Knights of Gothria, an all-but-extinct chivalrous order from his homeland in the cold north. At his side he wore a large and heavy sword with a grip of spiral-carved ivory inlaid with gold, its gilded pommel crowned with a brilliant-cut gem the color of a late afternoon sky. Though members of the Order were permitted to wear their weapons at any time, most left them in their rooms when not actually expecting a duel, but Carden was never without his. When he saw that Tsuwabuki had entered, he stopped trying to get Keiko to speculate on what the hell was going on, grinned at the council president, and leaned back against the wall behind Keiko, arms folded, his burly frame deceptively casual. Slim and swarthy Lantar Ibzaltir, at the other end of the table, had dressed up his white jacket with a sash of colorful silk from his native Shalhara. He wore regular dress pants and practical boots, but Tsuwabuki knew that as soon as the weather turned just a little warmer, Lantar would be back in his homeland's traditional baggy green trousers and rope sandals. His shalkava, a 5-foot pole topped with an axe blade that sported a spike on top and a hook on the back, leaned against the wall behind him. Like Carden, he grinned at the sight of Tsuwabuki entering. As always, Tsuwabuki was struck by how large and white his teeth were. Next to Lantar, Peregrine Took had turned her chair sideways and was actually sitting on one of the arms, with her soft leather-shod feet up on the other, elbows on knees. She had to do this, as she was only a little more than 3 feet tall, and would barely have been able to see over the table if she'd been sitting normally. Her uniform was slightly too big for her, which had nothing to do with her small stature. It was just that the Academy's first non-Sephirian student, if you didn't count the pillar, who had studied there briefly after his investiture, had little use for formal clothes and disliked the way the council uniform fit when properly sized. Alone among the duelists, she seemed to carry no weapon.
"Well, here is himself now,"
she said in her broad Westmarch burr, raking a handful of her curly, dark blonde hair back from her eyes as she spoke and favoring Tsuwabuki with an impish grin.
"Maybe we'll get to hear what's so important. It cannot wait till after lunch."
"I'd be interested to learn that myself," remarked Kanai Otori quietly. Kanai was the end of the world, the designated deputy to the White Prince, whose job was to oversee the doings of the Order of the Rose in the Prince's absence, which was most of the time. The others liked to call her their token adult, and in reality she left them mostly to themselves, confident in Tsuwabuki's ability to manage the day-to-day affairs of the Council, both as student governors and as duelists. Tall, slender, green-eyed and ash-blonde, she wore a more ornate uniform than the students, but the cut was similar, and she wore a thin-bladed broadsword at her side. Tsuwabuki nodded and took his place at the head of the table. "Well, I assume you all know by now about what Keiko and Card found on the dueling platform yesterday."
"Aye, we've heard," Peregrine said. "Is it true? You found a night elf?"
Suavuki nodded.
It's true.
What's a Svart Elf doing on the dueling platform?
Kanai asked.
That doesn't make any sense. She didn't come through the Rose Gate, did she?
Suabaki shook his head. No, he said. She's no sorceress. This isn't some kind of attempted invasion, like the thing that happened in Autozam a few years ago.
Then how'd she get up there? Cardan asked.
Suabaki looked from duelist to duelist for a moment, making sure he had all their attention, and then said,
She fell.
Fell? Lantar blurted.
From where?
Her homeland, Suabuki said. I don't understand how yet. Despite the fact that Svart Alfheim is above the dueling floor in some sense, it's not supposed to be possible for someone to fall from one to the other, but there it is. She did.
The crystal spheres should prevent that from happening, Kanai said.
I know, Suabuki replied. I'm looking through my books, trying to find out if there's any precedent for something like this happening. I haven't come up with anything yet, but...
He paused, lifting his spectacles momentarily to rub his dark-rimmed eyes.
There are a lot more tomes left to search. So far, I just don't have an answer for that part of the riddle, and she's just as much in the dark as I am. So to speak.
They say the fallen prince was half Svart Elven. Keiko mused thoughtfully.
So they do, Cardan agreed. Back in Gothria, we have legends about that. They say his mother came from somewhere in the far north, beyond Autozam. That there's a gate to another realm up there somewhere, maybe in Rio Zanpaku.
Suabuki sighed. Everybody has a theory about what Rio Zanpaku was supposed to be for, he said.
In any event, as I said, I'm still working on it. What I'm concerned about right now, what I called this meeting for, was because we need to decide what to do about Anaximandra.
Kanai raised an eyebrow.
That's her name?
Yes. Anaximandra Drax.
Peregrine raised both eyebrows.
Drax? As in the clan Drax, third of Wethringaroth.
Suavaki looked faintly surprised.
Well, as a matter of fact, yes, he said.
Peregrine bunched her face up with concern and whistled through her teeth.
Ooh, that's bad, that is.
Why?
Wethringaroth is one of the most hated houses in Svart Alfheim, she said. Their name means Shadow of Dread.
If a people call themselves that... You know their name what you'd call kindly folk. Even the other dark elves didn't like 'em.
How do you know these things? Lantar asked incredulously.
I read books, Peregrine replied piously. Or rather my cousin Tunk does, and then tells me what was in 'em, she allowed on further reflection. Any road, I canna say I like the idea of a Wethringaroth night elf in these parts.
Then it may relieve your mind, Perry, to know that she's in exile, Suavaki said dryly. She was cast out, literally. Apparently, when the Svart Elves of her house declare someone beyond the Pale, they throw them down a well in the lowest part of their underground city. It's believed to be bottomless.
What did she do? Keiko wondered.
I don't know. She won't talk about it, at least not yet. The point is, we can't send her back to her people. They'd just try again, and maybe succeed. I won't be a party to that.
This isn't going where I think it's going, is it? Cardan asked.
Suabuki nodded.
Look, he said, spreading his hands. She's scared and in shock. Her own people tried to kill her day before yesterday, and it's only through some bizarre stroke of luck we don't understand that she survived at all. She's got nowhere else to go. I think we should admit her to the academy and look after her for a while.
Are you putting this to a vote? Keiko asked with a little smile tugging at her lips. Or just telling us what you're going to do?
Suabuki blushed a little with a wry smile. I'll put it to a vote if I have to, but I was hoping to just find out what you think.
I'm not sure I like it, Lentar said slowly. Loath as I am to deny the Academy's hospitality to anyone, he added hastily. I'd feel better if we knew a little more about this girl before opening the doors of the whole school to her. Perhaps we should confine her somewhere, Suabaki's Tower, for instance, until we can be more sure of her.
She hasn't done anything wrong, Keiko pointed out. You can't just preemptively lock someone up for coming from a bad part of town.
I agree, Carden said. Besides, with us to look after her, she shouldn't be able to cause too much trouble, even if it turns out that she wants to.
Can I? You're supposed to be in charge here. What do you think? Keiko asked.
Kanai looked thoughtful for a few minutes, then said, If Mitsuru takes responsibility, I'm not going to be one to speak out against giving anyone an honest chance.
Of course I do, Suabaki said. It's my idea, after all.
Then I guess the eyes have it, Carden said. Next question is, what are we going to do with her? I don't think it'd be the best idea to just toss her into the Res Life housing pool.
We could send word to Prince Tenjo, ask if we can put her in East Hall, Keiko suggested.
Or, though I don't hold with Lantar's idea of confining her there, there's the spare space in my tower, Suavaki said. I have a whole suite of rooms on the level below my study that I never use.
East Hall would be a lonely life for someone trying to find a new place to fit in, Kanai observed. So would the tower, come to that. Both places were designed to set their inhabitants apart.
Well, we can't expect some random student to...
She can come and stay with me,
Perry interjected, derailing the discussion entirely. Everyone turned to look at her.
I thought you didn't like the idea of her staying at all, Carden said. Now you're inviting her to room with you? Why?
Perry regarded him seriously for a moment, then grinned and sprang up onto the table, hands on hips, dark blue eyes twinkling.
Because I'm a Took, she said, and we didn't know any better. Besides, she went on, lying down on the table with her lower legs hanging over the edge and her hands behind her curly head. She's an exile, yeah? We've a long and honorable tradition of taking in strays in the Shire. We can't bear to let anyone go without an hot meal and a soft place to sleep.
Suabaki grinned. Thanks, Perry, he said. Then, rising, he added, I guess we're agreed, then.
Kanai, will you send word to the Trinity about this? I know they're very, preoccupied right now, but they should at least be informed. Tell them I'm working on it, and there's nothing happening that they need to concern themselves with at this point.
Kanai nodded.
I'll do that. Thank you, Mitsuru. All of you. It's good to see that the Student Council is upholding the Academy's principles of fairness and extending an open hand to someone in need.
Keiko got up and threaded her sword through her belt.
What would you have done if we'd decided to turn her away? She asked.
I don't interfere with the business of the council, Kanai replied, but I would have been very disappointed.
Perry sat up and hopped down from the table, then ducked underneath it to make for the exit.
Speaking about meals, I've just enough time before my next class for a spot a second breakfast. You'll bring me a new roommate by after lunch, Mitsuru? I'll be studying from 2 to 4.
Suabaki grinned.
Sure.
Orifas.
Akio Otori stood in front of an ebony-framed mirror, smoothing the creases of his dress uniform and considering the impression carefully. He hadn't worn the new one, black where the old had been white, blood red where the old had been blue, very often, preferring to dress casually around the Institute whenever possible. He still felt a little odd, so attired. The cut was still unfamiliar, not as ingrained in his habits as the false prince's uniform had been. At a sound from the door, he turned to see Toga Kiryu, similarly garbed.
What do you think, Toga? Akio asked. Perhaps doing away with the double-breasted jacket was a mistake.
Toga looked mildly perplexed and offered no opinion. Akio let it hang for a second, then chuckled.
Perhaps not. Is everything ready?
Toga nodded.
I'm uncomfortable with you going alone, he said, but Akio brushed it aside.
We've already discussed this, Toga, he said. You attract far too much attention, and all of it the wrong kind.
At least...
Toga hesitated, as if he couldn't quite believe what he was about to suggest, then gritted his teeth and got on with it.
At least take Nanami.
You will take any opportunity to separate yourself from your sister, won't you? Akio asked, amused. And after all I did to bring the pair of you together at last, I can't help but feel a trifle hurt.
Toga scowled, but said nothing. Akio sighed.
Very well, he conceded, inclining his head slightly. I'll take Nanami along. Perhaps she'll evoke some interesting reactions of her own. It might be entertaining, if nothing else. Inform her. We leave within the hour.
Toga nodded, turned, and left the room. After he was gone, Akio smiled ironically.
It might be entertaining indeed.
Sephiro.
It took Tsuwabuki a while to figure out just how to handle the slight problem of accommodating Anaximandra Drax at the academy. There was no problem with where she would stay, thanks to Perry, and no question that she was provisionally welcome, but there was the small matter of her sensitivity to sunlight, of which the campus received more than its fair share most days. The standard girl's uniform, with its short sleeves and miniskirt, would leave a lot of her exposed to the sun, and then there were her eyes to be considered. Tsuwabuki worked on the problem for several hours before finally conceding defeat and consulting Master Clef, then was mildly gratified to learn that the ancient master had to look up a possible solution himself. Fortunately, the trusty CRC Handbook of Alchemy and Metaphysics came to the rescue, providing a recipe for a simple alchemical preparation. This wouldn't entirely solve the problem, but it would at least bring it down to manageable levels while Tsuwabuki looked for something better. Thus, Anaximandra wore a broad-brimmed hat and carried a parasol, but didn't have to cover herself from head to foot and wear a welder's mask to walk outside, and so she was relatively normally dressed when she arrived at Peregrine Took's room in South Hall. Tsuwabuki was relieved to see that Perry had tidied the place up a bit, if only a bit, in anticipation of her new roommate. Not that her room was usually dirty, as such, but in Tsuwabuki's experience it was often chaotic. Perry's people were not known for their meticulous housekeeping, and with no roommate to worry about discommoding, she tended to keep things in piles, with unsteady stacks of books teetering next to jumbled heaps of papers and whatnot. There was still some of that going on, but she'd confined it all to one side of the room now, causing the junk density on top of her desk to double, but leaving the other half clear.
"Hello, hello, come in," she said cheerfully, waving Tsuwabuki and his charge into the room. "You're right on time. I just finished sorting some of the clobber to make room for you. Welcome to South Hall. I'm Peregrine Took. Perry, if you like."
Anaximandra blinked. "You're a halfling?" she inquired. Perry tilted her head with a thoughtful frown.
"Well, I suppose so," she said. "We prefer Vetir, though. We're nae half o' anything, you see," she added with a smile.
"I'm sorry," Anaximandra said, lowering her eyes. "I didn't mean to offend you."
Perry gave a cheerful snort. "Peh! I've been offended by experts," she said. "Don't think of it."
"Well, if you two are all right, I'll push off," Tsuwabuki said. "Things to attend to, you know."
"I'd run along, then," said Perry with a grin and a dismissive wave. "I'll take it from here."
Suwabiki grinned, bowed, and exited.
"Well," Perry said, "someone else from the upper planes. This'll be interesting. Has Suwabiki given you the book, then?"
Anaximandra blinked again.
"The book?"
Perry smacked herself in the forehead with the heel of one hand.
"That lad, I swear," she said. "Clever and not hard to look at. But you have to beat him with a stick to get any work out of him."
She went to one of her stacks of books, scanned the spines, and yanked a volume out of the middle, causing the rest of the pile to collapse in a heap. Seeing to pay the collapse no mind, she crossed the room and handed her prize over to Anaximandra, who took in the cover with interest.
"So you fell from a great height, a celestial outcast's survival guide to the mortal plane."
Anaximandra favored her new roommate with a skeptical look and asked,
"Is this a joke?"
Perry shook her head.
"One thing about me," she said with a twinkle in her eye, "is that you'll never have to ask when I'm joking. You'll know. So, which bunk do you fancy? I've been using the top one, but I'm flexible."
"The lower one's fine, thank you, Perry."
"Fine then, fine indeed."
Perry nodded with an air of satisfaction, then tilted her head again.
"What do I call you? I kinda keep saying Anaximandra, Anaximandra, over and over again. That'll take all day. Did you have a nickname back in the City of Secrets?"
Anaximandra looked up from the book and shook her head.
"We aren't much for informalities in Svartalfheim." "Nay, you wouldn't be. Stupid question,"
Perry agreed, shaking her head.
"Well, I'll have to take matters into me own hands, then. Never mind, I'm good at that. I'll come up with something by the end of the week."
Grinning, she went to her desk, sat down, and started rummaging around again.
"You go on reading, then, and if you have any questions, just ask. Meantime, I seem to have buried my next class assignment."
Anaximandra assured her that she would speak up with any questions she might have, then return to her reading. As she read over the first part of the introduction, she felt herself smiling just a little bit. Perry was quite right, after all. This was going to be interesting. Friday, March 5th, 2410. Deedlit Satori Mandeville Memorial Institute. Gerardo, Bahava L System, Centaurus Sector. Boba Fett was checking the last of his blasters when Sakura Byakuro appeared in the doorway to his room just off the upper level of the castle's great hall, sword case in hand.
"Hey, are you ready to go?" she asked.
"Just about." Fett slapped the power pack back into the blaster, set the safety interlock, and put the weapon in its holster, then tucked the whole affair into the duffel bag that sat in the middle of the open anvil case in front of him. Sakura just goggled at him for a moment, then put her hands on her hips.
"Boba, come on," she said. "You're packing all your bounty hunting crap?"
Fett gave her an arched eyebrow.
"You're carrying a bunch of your ninja crap," he said pointedly.
"That's different. I'm a ninja. We swear oaths about that kind of thing. But geez, we're going to a wedding."
Gesturing at the various items nestled into the anvil case's conformal foam, Sakura went on,
"There is no conceivable way you're going to need body armor, a duffel bag full of weapons, and a jetpack."
Boba opened his mouth to reply, but before he could do so, the booming voice of General Krog, the Duelist Society's visiting former faculty advisor, reverberated through the great hall in his native tongue.
"Move out, you laggards! Anyone not out here in 2 minutes is walking to the spaceport!"
Once the rafters stopped ringing, Boba grinned at Sakura and pointed out,
"We're going to Corwin's wedding."
Now it was Sakura's turn to consider the point. She did so, then nodded. Wait here, she said. I'm going to go get the rest of my ninja stuff.
Avery Productions Unlimited presented Undocumented Features Future Imperfect, The Order of the Rose, a Duelist Opera, Out of the Blue. The opera will continue.